listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Danielle DiMartino Booth. And Ms. Booth is the founder of Money Strong, LLC. It's an economic consulting firm, and she began her career in New York with Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenneret, and also with Credit Suisse, where she worked in fixed income in the public and private equity markets. And after working as a financial columnist, she worked at the Dallas Morning News and then went on to work as an advisor to Richard Fisher at the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas. Danielle is also the author of Fed Up, which she talked to us about here on this show in the past. That's Fed Up, an insider's take on why the Federal Reserve is bad for America. And how refreshing it is to have an insider talk honestly about an institution she worked for. Wish we had more people like her, which is one of the reasons I'm thrilled to have her on the show again. Thanks for joining me again, Danielle.
You know, I'm happy to be here, and I think honesty is one of the most important things. And I'll just give you a little teaser by saying I'm not as negative as I've been in the past on the Fed.
Good. Well, since I believe it's coming from an honest person, I'm glad to hear that. We hear a lot of happy talk about the Fed, and everything is coming up roses. We've heard that constantly, and somehow it hasn't always worked out or hasn't usually worked out as well as people have said, although depending on who you are. I guess if you're on Wall Street, you're doing quite well, and there's reason to think everything is pretty honky-dory. But if you're in middle America, not so much so, I suppose. Anyway.
And that's exactly the case. It's bizarre, but where are we? A decade after the worst of the crisis is come and gone, and so many Americans, I would venture to say, feel like they've been stuck in a rut for 10 years or more. It's a shame.
Has been the case. I know the area that I grew up in, northeastern Ohio, the Rust Belt, people are hurting pretty bad back there, and some of them are taking to some very serious drugs and all kinds of problems. So it is... economics has its consequences. Monetary dishonesty has its consequences, that's for sure. Well, I looked at the Fed funds rate. I looked at a chart, and I saw late December is 1.41%. Does that sound about right for Fed funds?
Yes, it is in that cute little range that they have. How I do wish we could go back to making moves of a half of a percentage point, or and when it wasn't something that you needed to get a microscope out to decipher.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but still, that compares to something like 8 basis points for a good part of the time for a few years, or a quarter of a percent or whatever. It was abysmally low, and so that's quite a rise in interest rates already, though, isn't it? I mean, in terms from where we were. To what extent?
Well, I'm not going to dwell on the point.
Yeah.
But I would add that for the people you mentioned on Main Street, not to use a cliche, that differential between basically 0 and 1.5, I promise you, it's come out in their variable borrowing costs. It has not been reflected yet in what savers can make. So there's the other irony, is even with rising interest rates, you still stick it to the average working Joe and Jane in one way, but they don't benefit in the other.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? It's terrible. To what extent, Danielle, it's my belief that the Fed has control over the short end of the yield curve, the short-term interest rates, but a lot less on the long rate, on the long end of the yield curve. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that, and we've certainly seen a lot of that in the past few weeks. We've seen a much more dramatic move on the short end as the market begins to price in further rate hikes by the new incoming team on the Federal Open Market Committee, and the long end is sniffing out kind of the governor on growth that will create. So the Fed's not able to push up long rates the way that it would prefer to be able to do.
What do you, so the new Fed, the new Fed chairman coming in, how do you think he will change things? To what extent will he change things? What's his philosophy, and what can we expect from him?
You know, and this is where it gets really tricky, because I don't want to make it sound like he's an elitist, because I don't think that he is. But by the same token, there's something to be said for somebody whose public net worth is the highest of any on the FOMC. And we know, because of documentations that have been filed, that he and his family are worth upwards of $55 million.
Mm-hmm.
And Jay, I will tell you, when I wrote about Jay Powell, a quiet leader, this is something that I published shortly after the Senate confirmation hearing, I got a lot of flack. The Wall Street Journal called me up and they said, do you stand by this? You're saying it's virtuous that he's wealthy? And I said, it's extremely virtuous that he's wealthy, because he's not beholden to anybody, and he doesn't need the Fed's pension at all. He doesn't need the perks that go along with the position. He's just serving his country the same way he served his country when he worked for a salary of $1 shortly before coming on to the Fed to explain to Congress the perils of letting the U.S. default on its debt. There's something to be said for independence, is my point.
Oh, absolutely. And honesty, as you also pointed out. What is driving interest rates higher now? Do you think it is a stronger economy? And we've had Alistair McLeod on our show recently of Gold Money, and he's talked about how he believes we're at this point in the credit cycle. You know, when interest rates start to rise, banks have to, well, they people have more confidence in the economy, banks have more confidence, so they're willing to start lending. But also, if they sit around holding treasuries, they lose money by holding treasuries. But what is really driving the interest rates? Is it really a strong economy, or is it a combination of the Fed, you know, taking its foot off the accelerator a little bit and letting liquidity dry up? Or what is driving rates higher? To what extent is it a market function as opposed to a Fed policy move?
So I'm not going to be very elegant here, and I apologize in advance. Mother Nature is driving the economy right now. Mother Nature's at the wheel.
Good.
If you look back to other prior years, you know, Hurricane Katrina was pretty much the biggest disruption and caused the greatest amount of damage to the economy that then had to be replaced. Now, last week there was a report out that said that insurers nationwide in 2017 suffered a $306 billion hickey. That's losses. But look at losses in the mirror and tell me that that's not money that's going to be poured back into the economy just to repair and rebuild what Hurricane Harvey, Irma, Maria, two massive wildfires, the largest in California history. Money that is destroyed, wealth that is destroyed, assets that are destroyed, that can be replaced with insurance proceeds, that is money that pours into an economy that was slowing prior to Hurricane Harvey making that first landfall. It is math.
Well, it almost sounds that you're making virtue of Keynesian economics in a sense.
Well, Keynesian, I mean, I don't think Mother Nature is Keynesian.
But it is
a sugar high. I want to emphasize that.
Okay.
The automobile industry was in a flat out year over year recession. Automobiles were contracting as a sector before Harvey hit. And then there were all of a sudden overnight a million cars that needed to be replaced. And lo and behold, woohoo, look at car sales. Look at how robust they are. I mean, you know, I look at the word robust and I have to put it in quotes. I'm like, you destroy a million, you replace a million. Fine. And then you move on. What next with subprime automobile delinquencies going through the roof, with VHA mortgage delinquencies pushing 10% as of the third quarter, with credit card loss provisions rising, with signs that households are under stress? That's what's underneath. But right now what we're seeing is this sugar high as money pours into the economy. It's just like cash for clunkers. It was very, very temporary, and it didn't have any permanent effects on the economy.
Right. Well, we need some permanent positive effects, and I guess to get back to the basic the basics of economics, supply and demand, and forget all this the sugar highs, ultimately. Well, I would like to refer to an article you wrote January 10th titled "The Great Recovery: Unambiguous Clarity Over the Horizon." You talked about a failed inflation gauge. How is our inflation gauge, how is it constructed and how has it failed?
Well, right now what policymakers prefer to use is called the core PCE.
Right.
Excuse me, personal consumption expenditures. If you look at that number, it underweights housing to such a degree as to be insulting to the average household. Insulting. Mm-hmm. I don't use that word lightly. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Harvard University and its real estate center. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold.
Oh, I'm sorry. But
Harvard has identified some 40% of Americans now who spend an extraordinary, they're extremely distressed in terms of the amount of their budget that they have to allocate to housing. And yet, the Fed's favorite inflation metric understates housing to a great degree. And then it overstates medical care to a great degree because of Medicaid and Medicare reimbursements. But that doesn't take away from what the average household has to spend on health care.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I can empathize with you. I've been through it hosting a show at times when you have to battle a cold, and it's not a lot of fun. I'm sorry you're having to deal with that.
But I did meet Ron Paul over the weekend, so life is good.
Oh, you did what?
I did get to meet Ron Paul over the weekend, so it's not all bad.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'm sure he would be delighted to and probably reads your stuff. He certainly knew the Fed chairman Greenspan very well in his days in the House. So, and I know he's very as an Austrian economist, very very concerned about monetary policy, and I'm sure he must find your views quite refreshing at times. Anyway,
well, look, if you want to go back to the inflation metric and some dinner time conversation that Dr. Paul and I had, it had to do with the Fed following this wrong inflation metric and how very destructive that can be, because if you're saying, I won't make a move until it hits 10%, but by its very design, it's never going to hit, 2%, but by its very design, it's never going to hit 2%, that sows the seeds of malinvestment and the economic destruction that follows in its path.
Well, we've certainly seen that. I know we've had economist John Williams on this show in the past, too, and he's talked about, his measures of inflation, talked about hedonic pricing that's come along, I think, during maybe the Bush 1, and also some things that took place during the Reagan administration, too. Substitution, if steak gets too expensive, you just simply substitute it with hamburger or something like that. Those kind of gimmicks that he's gone back and looked at inflation. If we use the same sort of measurement, the same sort of items in the index as we used going back in Reagan, that the real inflation rate, the real cost of living, and I used to hear people talk about the cost of feeding a family of four or something like that, cost of taking care of a family. We don't hear that kind of talk anymore. But what does it really cost for the basic household? And what you're saying is the housing cost is really underscored. I mean, is underrated to a great extent. So anyway, the point is that if we have
a third of a household budget, is typically housing, if not more.
Yeah, and if you live in San Francisco or New York, as I do, it's probably more than that for a lot of people. Well, so if you have the wrong index and you're suggesting that inflation is a lot lower than it is, then you can just keep pumping the money, and that's what they've been doing, pumping the system full of narcotics, I guess, and getting everybody, or the sugar, as you say, sugar high. So there's still, though, people in the Fed, I think your article was pointing out, that are concerned about not enough inflation, right? So we need to keep goosing it more.
If you listen to, I was referring to some comments that were made by Charlie Evans last week, and in fact, he's going to be on the wires again this week. But he remains concerned that inflation is too low. You know, I like to joke that I can't say those words in front of my retired mother, who lives on a very modest pension, because if you say inflation's too low, she'll whip out her latest receipt from the pharmacy, or from going to the doctor, or from filling up her gas tank.
Mm-hmm. Danielle, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying it's ridiculous. So, but I would like you to refer, if you wouldn't mind, to the image that I depicted last week for the Great Recovery, because the Great Recovery is something that I really wanted to say tongue in cheek. You know, if you look at 2014, it was kind of the year that was. If you look at 2015, we looked at it ex energy. If you looked at 2016, we looked at it as ex retail. I propose that economists will look at 2018 as being ex autos and 2019 as being ex restaurants. As long as you carve out the part of the economy that is sickly, then everything's fine.
Well, that's the propaganda, I guess, to keep Wall Street happy, or what's driving it? Because it's not keeping middle America happy, that's for sure. And the common folks like your mother and, you know, people that that have to live on average incomes, I'm sure, you know, some of the people at the Fed don't have to worry too much about that.
Well, of course not. Again, if you have a pension for life, you're not going to be concerned, but you are going to want to stay at the Fed. And you are going to be concerned with your legacy. And again, these are things that I don't think that Jay Powell is going to be susceptible to that.
Yeah.
Now,
good
that
point.
Might mean that he gets that might mean that he does not agree with the White House almost immediately. We will have to see when he's first tested.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'm Michael Oliver, who we have on our show, because he's just so darn good in terms of his technical analysis. He worked with E.F. Hutton, International Commodity Division, a long time ago. He's a veteran technical analyst, but he's a momentum and structural guy. He's just absolutely spot on, more than any other technical person I've ever used. So he's on our show almost constantly, almost every week. But he's really very I don't know that I'd say he's concerned. He sees a substantial amount of inflation in the commodity sector rising up, which I gather will probably, you know, eventually, unless the Fed can X out everything they don't want to have in there that makes inflation look higher than it really is. He's concerned that people are going to start paying a lot more for their food, especially agricultural commodities, he thinks, are in the start of a real bull market. Commodities in general, he's very bullish on. I sort of gathered from reading one of your remarks that you may share that sentiment.
Look, the producer price index recently hit a 6-year high. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to the Mother Nature thing. When you have all these homes burned down or flood, imagine what that's going to do to commodities prices.
Sure.
That's exactly what we've seen in spades. And the fact that so many policymakers dismiss input prices, I mean, at their peril. And, mm-hmm. and as you say, what we've seen happen in the agricultural complex is enormous. And this will feed into what people have to spend to put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's one thing that I consider to be particularly encouraging about Jay Powell, and we can mm-hmm. talk about him because everybody's going to be talking about him for the next few months until he presides over his first meeting in late March.
Mm-hmm.
But before he left the private sector, his sole focus was on the industrial sector.
Mm.
This is not someone who's going to ignore producer prices. He worked with the manufacturing sector. He worked closely with the automobile industry. That was what he did in the private sector. So he mm-hmm. understands things like margin squeeze, and he sure as heck understands asset prices gone wild. He was the one who, in October 2012, one of his first meetings, he was a rookie, and he still managed to say before QE3 was rolled out, what if this becomes habit forming? Well, I mean, like, that's a strong word for me, habit forming. This is somebody who sees right through the fact
yep.
that so much of what the Fed has done has benefited Wall Street and hurt Main Street.
And so it has become habit-forming, and to break it, like any serious addiction, it's going to be very, very painful. If and when it's addicted and is broken, when how do you think, to what extent do you think the Fed is really scared to death of a stock market crash, and they might have to keep, you know, concocting false inflation numbers so they can keep justifying pumping more money in? Do you think that's something that Powell may object to?
Well, given what his opinions have been in the past on quantitative easing, and we only mm-hmm. have really 5 meetings to go off of because transcripts
yeah.
are released with a 5-year delay, which is
yeah.
ridiculous. And they're redacted on top of that, which nobody wants to talk about that boogeyman at all, but they are mm-hmm. redacted.
Mm-hmm.
But given his prior opinions on QE, his true test, as you rightly state, is going to be when the stock market corrects.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, he was part of the FOMC under Janet Yellen that voted to say that the shrinkage of the Fed's balance sheet was not going to be data dependent, that it was going to occur in the background as if you were watching paint dry. Well, guess what? Even if the Fed stops hiking interest rates, say after March or June, and just manages to hike rates twice more this year, getting it up to maybe 2%, they're committed to continue on a tightening path by reducing the amount of liquidity that they pump up into the system, by allowing that balance sheet, that $4 trillion war chest they've built up, to run off. So Jay Powell's got not one, but two big tests coming up when these markets begin to correct.
With just a couple of minutes, three or four minutes left here, I want to ask you about the dollar. The dollar's been a lot weaker recently. Of course, you can go back over a number of years, and it's certainly not at its low point yet. But to what extent, and the Fed never seems to want to talk about the dollar. It always, remember Greenspan never wanted to talk about the dollar. But to what extent, I mean, that has to weigh on the Fed's mind, you would think. A dollar that is going down substantially, it is the world's reserve currency. China, Russia, a lot of countries now are starting to say, we're getting kind of tired of the dollar. You guys created out of nothing. You have a petrodollar, but now Saudi Arabia sells most, I think China's its largest customer, and China's saying, we don't want dollars anymore, we want yuan. If you don't like yuan, you can take yuan and go over and buy gold with it. To what extent do you think geopolitics and the potential for a dollar decline plays into the Fed's thinking and might actually, as it did back in the late 70s and the 1980, sort of play into the Fed's decision to hike rates aggressively? I mean, I can't imagine they could even come close to doing anything like they did, like Volcker did in 1980. But to what extent might the dollar actually play into the Fed's policymaking, even though they never talk about the dollar?
Well, it's interesting. The Fed... China played a game of chicken with the Fed in September 2015, and Janet Yellen's, the FOMC statement that eventually followed in December 2015 and the minutes that followed had the dollar sprinkled everywhere. Now, as a former Fed insider, this was the biggest no-no I had ever seen in black and white. Because it's not the Fed's purview to talk about the dollar. That is strictly, theoretically, the purview of the Treasury. But to answer your question, of course it disturbs them. The Bank of Japan is unwittingly and unwillingly, because of how they have constructed their quantitative easing, they're tapering. The European Central Bank has started to taper its purchases.
Right.
This is when you start to get into a currency war. If everybody starts to tighten at the same time, and all of a sudden the dollar is not the go-to currency, and you tack on geopolitics and Xi Jinping and his ambitions for the yuan, and the fact that, yes, China is now the largest importer of oil, so why bother with the petrodollar?
Right. I believe that the Shanghai Oil Exchange, the futures exchange, is supposed to open for business in a couple of days from now. So that should be really interesting. I know the mainstream doesn't talk about it at all. The Fed never talks about it. The Treasury never talks about it. But really some interesting times. Danielle, I'm really thankful that you could come on and talk to us a little bit. Your insights are so welcome. And refreshingly honest. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope we can do it again sometime in the not too distant future.
Absolutely.
But we are out of time now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Danielle. Well, folks, next week, Daniel McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity will be with us. Michael Oliver as well. And Nav Dalawal from Bonterra Resources, a company that I'm following very closely. It should be an interesting time. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Uranium Energy Corp.
NYSE Market, UEC.
Is a leader in the coming bull market in uranium. With spot uranium up more than 40% in 2 months, the new bull market is just starting. UEC has the cash, the licensed resources, the permitted processing center, the advanced technology, and the experienced team to lead this market. Get to know this exciting company now by visiting UraniumEnergy.com. NYSE Market, UEC.